This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It sounds so old-fashioned, dark, dusty, Victorian. It took the deaths of 12 desperate miners in West Virginia to remind the nation just how dependent the United States is on coal. More than half of the electricity produced in America comes from the same fuel that fired Andrew Carnegie's steel mills and the first huffing steam engine trains that crossed the continent. The mining industry calls it buried sunshine, but clean it is not. Coal produces more CO2 pollution each year than all America's cars combined. And mining itself comes with now clear dangers and environmental costs, but coal may be the future. Up next on Point, mourning in West Virginia and a new century still hooked on coal. Joining me now is West Virginia Public Radio's Dan Hyman, who's on the road from Sago to Charleston, West Virginia. He spoke with families in the Sago Church Tuesday night after the church bells rang and again when the news came that their loved ones had died. Dan Hyman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Describe for us, if you would, Dan, the community that you left behind in Sago at this point.
Well, it's a small rural area. I think that an economist I spoke to one time described West Virginia well when he said it was a rural industrial state. It's really a town that's very close-knit, it's very small, and pretty much everyone in the community either has a relative or a friend who works at the Sago mine. It's also deeply ingrained in the area that a number of people, their fathers and uncles, have always been coal miners.
Dan, these were very experienced miners underground at Sago. Has it become any more clear exactly how this awful miscommunication about the fate of the miners took place?
As far as we can tell, it seems as if there was some kind of a translation problem or a miscommunication on the walkie-talkies or radios that were being used between there were two groups of rescuers underground and then there was a command center above ground. And somewhere in that communication, there was something that got garbled or there was a mistake there. And then what happened after it got to the command center is that really everyone was hoping for good news so much that the story spread much more quickly than it should have. It leaked out. Part of the problem, and I think the company's coming in for a lot of criticism and the government a little bit of criticism as well, is that they waited too long, really, before telling the press and the family what the real story was.
We read that the news came in from the mine into a speaker box, a kind of squawk box in the command center at the mine. Everybody heard it, and out went the news, and it took a long time to get it set straight. What about the explosion itself, Dan? The miners reportedly found, as we're reading here, in positions of repose behind the curtain they'd put up to try and seal off the toxic fumes in the mine. But the source of the explosion itself, do we know?
Well, it's still unclear. This mine has unfortunately had a pretty significantly bad safety record. In fact, parts of this mine were shut down, I think I read, 15 times in the last year. That's really unusual in coal mining. They almost never force a mine to cease operation unless it's pretty serious. That's a dramatically bad safety record.
Right now, joining me from Saratoga, New York, is Jeff Goodell. His essay, headlined Black Gold or Black Death, appeared in yesterday's New York Times. He's author of the best-selling book, Our Story, 77 Hours That Tested Our Friendship and Our Faith, based on the 2002 accident where 9 miners were trapped underground in Pennsylvania. You may remember that. His upcoming book is Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Jeff Goodell, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Barbara Fries, former Assistant Attorney General of Minnesota, where she helped enforce the state's environmental laws. She now represents nonprofits in state proceedings to stop utilities from building new coal plants that do not use the latest clean technologies. She's author of Coal, A Human History. Barbara Fries, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jeff and Barbara both, I'll go to you first, Jeff, if I may. I want to get just your reactions to the news of this week in Sago, West Virginia. You're both very familiar with the coal mining industry. Jeff, when you heard the news, when you see how it's turned out, your first rush of thoughts?
Well, my first thought was, of course, not again, thinking back to Q Creek and what happened there. You know, and I, since the Q Creek mine accident in 2002, I'd spent a lot of time in that region of coal country of Appalachia in Pennsylvania and northern West Virginia. And, you know, I have to say there was it was not terribly surprising in a certain way, because that is a region known for dangerous mines and where there's a lot of problems with methane gases, and where you have a lot of small coal mines operated by small coal mining companies. And despite the improvements in the mining industry safety record, these are well known to be the most dangerous mines. And so, you know, it was a sad kind of recognition that, it, you know, that this had happened.
Barbara Fries, same question to you. It's been an awful few days of whiplash here for the country and that community with its terrible loss. You followed coal for a long time. Your thoughts?
Well, of course, this is an absolutely heartbreaking loss, and I think we all have to recognize the tragedy that these individuals and their families are dealing with. If you look over time, coal mining has, of course, been always a very dangerous profession. It is much safer now than it used to be, but still quite dangerous, and every now and then we get a tragic reminder of that.
I see in the numbers here, in West Virginia alone, 1900 through the year 1969, 19,544 West Virginia miners died. Jeff, the blood history here is a very deep and long one. But in this new tragedy, what do we see? Is this the exception that proves the rule that mining has become a much safer business to be in, or is there something wrong here?
Well, I think that, you know, talking about the danger of coal mining is a little bit like talking about the danger of being a police officer. If you're, you know, patrolling a shopping mall in Beverly Hills, it's probably not very dangerous. If you're working, you know, on the street beat in a, you know, a neighborhood that's full of guns and drugs, it's going to be a lot more dangerous. And so I think it's very difficult to generalize about it. You obviously have very large mines in places like Wyoming and Pennsylvania that are run by big corporations that are very that put a lot of attention on safety and are very safe. On the other hand, you have these smaller mines in Appalachia. And one of the things that's making these mines in Appalachia particularly dangerous is actually two things. One is the sort of sudden interest in coal and the prices that are very high right now, so it's causing a lot of people to go after coal that they might have considered too difficult and expensive to get at before. And it's important to note that this area has been mined for 120 years or so, and so all the easy coal is gone, and what's left is the harder stuff to get, and it's going to be more dangerous.
The easy stuff is gone, but Barbara Fries, looking at the numbers here, I'm kind of astounded to be reminded just how dependent the nation is on coal today and how that dependence looks likely to go on for a long time.
Well, I think it remains to be seen just how long it goes on for. But certainly if you look at all of the trends that we have right now, not only are we highly dependent on coal right now, but that will continue.
Dan, I wanted to ask you, Jeff Goodell was pointing out that coal has had quite a resurgence in recent years. Has that been evident in West Virginia coal country? Has there been a kind of, you know, let the good times roll until this tragedy struck?
Oh, very definitely. The price of some West Virginia coal has doubled and, in fact, tripled in the last few years. And, in fact, this mine itself was reopened because the price of coal is up. And as I said, was saying before, it was a mine with a bad safety record. And there was indications that really that the, you know, it was recently sold and there were things that maybe weren't going on there that should have been going on.
When it comes to enforcement of mine safety, is there concern that there's been less enforcement recently? There's been a lot of regulatory relaxation in the last few years, in the Bush years. Has that been an issue?
There's a great deal of concern about that. Oftentimes, these mine companies will pay for violations. A typical non-fatal violation might be $40. A serious violation, even a cease and desist order, might be $450. Frankly, some of these coal companies don't even sneeze at $450.
Jeff Goodell, give us a sense of the circumstances that have brought coal back into good times, this week's tragedy aside, brought coal back into such prominence. And give us a sense by the numbers of the country's dependence on coal today.
Well, I think that you can explain America's dependence or interest in coal right now on two factors. One is the rising price of natural gas and, to a lesser degree, oil, which has made it alternative forms of generation increasingly expensive. That's a huge part of it. There's been a big build out of natural gas plants in the last decade or so. And now all of a sudden natural gas prices have quadrupled in the last 4 years, and a lot of these natural gas plants are sitting idle while coal remains cheap. But I think that one of the key issues for coal and why there's a resurgence now is that the coal industry, and by that I mean the electric power companies and the coal mining companies, have been very good for a number of years at keeping the American kind of electricity consumer distant from the true costs of their energy. They do not want people to make the connection between leaving the light on in the bathroom and dead coal miners in West Virginia, or global warming, or air pollution deaths, and things like that. And they've done a very good job of making sure that we don't make the connection between our light switch and a coal mine.
Barbara Fries, help us fill in the blanks. The U.S. has been called the Saudi Arabia of coal. Jeff Goodell writes that we've got enough coal to last 250 years, given all the talk about natural gas and oil shortages. From one view, that seems like a godsend. But what about the environmental cost of coal, at least as it's being used today?
Well, that is the big problem. I mean, when we talk about the true costs, even the death toll in the coal mines pales by comparison to the death toll associated with the pollution coming out of these coal plants. I think you could probably say that for every miner who dies in the mines, there are hundreds, maybe 1,000 people who die prematurely from heart and lung disease from the pollution caused by these coal plants. So that is one portion of the true costs. And as Jeff mentioned, another huge cost is global warming. Coal is an enormous contributor to this problem, which is probably not just the greatest environmental threat that humanity faces right now, but one of the greatest problems of any stripe. Certainly, it's been called a national security issue, and I think that it's important to recognize those implications. So what we're talking about here is a fuel that is cheap only artificially, only if you ignore the health, the environmental, and the safety costs that it imposes on not just miners, but on society generally.
Dan Hyman there in West Virginia, I know I've got you by the side of the road. I don't want to keep you forever, but give us the West Virginian view of this renaissance in coal use and the coal price. Is this welcomed? Is it seen as, you know, the American source of energy? Or, given the bitter history there, many dead over many years and all kinds of social ramifications of being dependent on the coal economy in West Virginia, do people fear a resurgence in coal?
Well, yes and no. It's a very complicated picture. In fact, that gets close to the heart of West Virginia's culture. In fact, the governor himself lost an uncle in a major mine disaster in 1968. So people really have a love-hate relationship with this. It's a very economically important industry. It's a source of good jobs, oftentimes that don't require a great deal of higher education in an area that really needs jobs. But at the same time, there's a definite sense of pain. Now, some of these small mining towns, the people are, all of them really are, they tend to be deeply stoic about this issue. They tend to regard it as just the hand that they're dealt. And I think that seeing people in Sago, West Virginia, and Tolmansville expressing this amount of anger about it suggests how deeply wounding this is. This is a town that, as I say, coal is in essence in their blood, and for them to lose this number of people is a real tragedy, and one that they have gotten to the point where they feel like they have to express their pain about that.
Dan, take us to that anger, if you would. We've heard all kinds of sort of muted reports about the anger after the news came out in the church. That's very understandable. The head of the coal company, we read, had to flee the church when people were lunging for him there, but there was a fire. There's talk of guns. What was the response in terms of anger, and where was it most directed?
I'm not sure that whether or not we can say for sure that the president of the coal company had to flee. there were clearly a certain amount of shouting and there was a certain amount of shoving that went on at the church after the announcement. Now, the press was not allowed in for that announcement. That was just with the company. But the families are very angry at the company. There's a certain amount of anger at the state government. There's probably going to be some anger at the federal government. We're not sure how far this is going to go in terms of, let's say, a grassroots level of frustration. But you also have to understand that people have been saying for years in this state that the mines are not regulated, the safety at the mines is not regulated the way that it should be.
Reporter there, Dan Hyman with West Virginia Public Radio. We're joined right now from Washington by Richard Trumka, Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. He's former president of the United Mine Workers of America. He led two major strikes against the Pittston Coal Company and the Bituminous Coal Operators Association. He's third generation in his family to work in the coal mines. Richard Trumka, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Speak to the safety issues and what we saw in Sago, if you would. I don't know how closely you're following it these days, but it's in your blood. The U.S. in general, we're told, has a good safety record on coal. So what do we see this week?
Well, I think you're seeing the results of an administration that has taken the emphasis off of enforcing the Mine Health and Safety Act and forming partnerships with the very industry that they're supposed to be enforcing the act with. This very mine and a number of small mines, whenever the price of coal goes up, small mines will jump into the market. Whenever the price goes down, they jump out of the market. Small mines historically have been far more unsafe, particularly non-union small mines. And this is one of those jobs. This is one of those mines. This is a mine that had changed hands several times. And the company that had it, Anchor, sold it in 1999. It was going bankrupt. Sold it to a contractor who had it for 2 years, went bankrupt. Sold it back to Anchor, who went bankrupt again. In the meantime, the number of violations were growing, and the trend at that mine was increasing. And unfortunately, it's a sad story that we've seen too often in this country. When you don't enforce the laws, people get killed needlessly.
And Mr. Trumka, the partnership you mentioned between the oversight, government oversight here and the industry, what is that exactly?
Well, instead of going in and enforcing the act, and when you find a violation, you write a citation or you write a closure order, and they are required to correct that situation immediately. They now go in on these things that they call compliance assistance, and they go in and urge the employer, the company, to comply with the Safety Act that they are statutorily required to comply with. It's called compliance assistance. And so there's a difference in emphasis. Prior to this time, MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, had been an enforcement agency. Now, if you will, it's sort of a consulting agency that does complying assistance.
Mm-hmm. Richard Trumka, we've just got you for another minute here, but you know the mines and the people there. With the price of coal pushing people into smaller, harder-to-reach areas, we're reading here about miners going into 20-inch seams. That, I guess, you go in on your belly to do that. But what is it like mining today? Is it the same old, you know, dirty, dangerous picture that we know from I guess, Hollywood of a century ago, or is it clean and nifty?
Well, you have technology, unfortunately, in this country changes so quickly. It stays about 4 or 5 years in front of the safety regulations. So you have machines that cut faster, create more airborne dust that can be, one, breathed and ingested and cause black lung and eye, ear, nose, throat infections and things of that sort. Plus, it is an explosive element. Most of the time, when you have an explosion in a coal mine, the original explosion may be caused by methane, but what happens is it kicks up dust, and then there's a series or a chain of explosions that are fueled by the coal dust that's in there. Now, they're supposed to put rock dust on that coal, which is crushed limestone, that makes that mixture of dust inert whenever it's kicked into the air. When that isn't done, you have a chain reaction. It'll blow all the way out to the fan, and you know, some of the explosions we've seen in the past where you've seen fans with black smoke coming out of the mine, those mines were not properly rock dusted, so the explosion continues. And unfortunately, the technology stays 4 or 5 years in front of the regulations.
You've been head of the United Mine Workers of America. So when you hear about the prospect, the possibility of coal playing not a smaller but a bigger role in American energy in this century, it sounds old-fashioned, but it could be in this century. That does mean jobs. Do you welcome that prospect or not?
Well, of course. I mean, America could become energy independent, and we can do it two ways. You can use coal. We have over 400 years of mineable reserves in the United States. It can be burned cleanly and consistent with a clean environment, and it can be done safely. It requires a commitment from the government to do both, and from the states, quite frankly, to do both. You know, we've endorsed a thing called the Apollo Project, which would help develop coal. It would help develop alternative fuel sources. It would help develop a number of things, efficiency, so that we become energy independent. I mean, much of the problems the country finds itself in, both economically and politically and internationally, stems from energy. We can become energy independent in this country if we decide to do it. We haven't made that decision yet. One thing I might add, as far back as the Second World War, the German war machine was run on a fuel that was made by liquefied coal. In 1949, Jennings Randolph flew from Morgantown, West Virginia, as a senator from West Virginia, to the Capitol in an airplane that was fueled with liquefied coal.
And there's a lot of talk of doing that again.
And here we are, 50-some years later, talking about doing it again.
Richard Trumka, former president of the United Mine Workers of America, secretary treasurer at the AFL-CIO. Mr. Trumka, thank you for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Barbara Fries, Mr. Trumka says it can be burned cleanly. I thought I heard you say otherwise.
Well, conceivably, it could be burned cleanly, but we're nowhere near doing that now. And for the most part, we're not really moving much in that direction. As I said, most of the new coal plants, the vast majority of the new ones, are not of this cleaner variety. Coal gasification does have potential, and there are a handful of new plants that have been proposed. But there are really three major steps that have to be taken in order to make coal not so climate destructive. First, you have to build a coal gasification plant, which is somewhat more expensive than a traditional one. But then secondly, you have to add on pollution controls that capture CO2. And then finally, you have to find a place to dispose of the millions of tons of CO2 that each coal plant would be producing every single year. So it's a path that could lead eventually to something cleaner. And I think when you're facing a problem as bad as climate change, you want to remain potentially open-minded to any solution, even one like coal gasification that could pose its own problems. But in the meantime, we have clean and safe options that we are not adequately investing in. And that's the real tragedy here. We could be spending that $100 billion instead of building conventional coal plants. We could be spending it on efficiency and on renewables and on means of storing energy so as to make renewables like wind, for example, more reliable. We're not doing that. And that is a real shame because the rest of the world, the rest of the developed world, is moving quickly away from coal. They've been doing it for a couple of decades, and they are developing these new energy technologies. We've got the resources, we've got the capital and the know-how, but we're spending our money in the wrong direction.
We've also got the coal and we're on a path to use it. Jeff Goodell, what's going to determine ultimately whether this is the coal century in the United States or the alternative energy century?
Well, you know, I don't know what will determine that. I mean, I think that, you know, it will be determined by how, you know, these kinds of accidents and things like this and how we feel about how much tolerance we have of them. But I want to add one thing here, which I think what Barbara said is absolutely true and right. But I think that there's a lot of distraction on this talk about new technology, about IGCC, coal liquefaction. All that is true and
clean
right.
Clean coal.
The essential problem with coal, in my view, is not technological, it's political. I mean, the problem is that if coal is going to sort of be a viable future for the 21st century, we need to have a whole number of political changes, of enforcement of regulations, of changing the way, you know, we think about energy. The main issue with the coal industry is they're enormously politically influential. They have enormous political inertia built up from 120 years of being friends with people in Washington and in state capitals. mills. You have the railroads, who are also incredibly powerful, working on their behalf because all this coal has to move around on railroads. Mm. So you've got an enormous industrial infrastructure that has a lot of political influence, and they want to shape the way we make these decisions. And they do not want individual energy consumers thinking about this.
And they're not necessarily invested in doing it in the cleanest and safest way. Barbara Friesa, a final thought from you. There's clearly a much bigger story than we stay attuned to here. This tragedy has alerted us to it again. This is going to be a huge issue in this country for a long time.
It's going to take us decades to figure this out, and it's important that we start now because you cannot change a massive energy infrastructure overnight. The problem we have right now is that we're still digging ourselves more deeply into the hole.
And Jeff Goodell, a final thought from your side here. Are there alternatives that could step up, or is it inevitable that we become more dependent on coal in the 20, 30, 40 years ahead?
Well, I think it's pretty much inevitable that we're going to become more dependent on coal in the next 20 or 30 years. I just think that the energy demand for energy is so high, and we have so much coal that, you know, it's going to get burned, a lot of it. But I think the real question is are we going to do it right and do it in a way that is environmentally responsible, that protects the health of workers, that addresses serious issues like climate change, or are we just going to, you know, have this enormous sort of environmental and human catastrophe on our hands by this industry that has too much power and gets away with too much stuff?
Jeff Goodell, author of the forthcoming Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Barbara Friesa, author of Coal, A Human History. Ms. Friesa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.